Thank you all for joining me this evening. I'm so happy to be with you in this virtual space. I'm just happy to be talking with you about practice that has been so core to my own spiritual development over many, many years, these heart practices. And I think primarily because the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes, loving kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity really are concerned with creating healthy relationships, right, in the relational world that many of us live in. This contemplative practice of meditation involves transforming how we relate to ourselves so that we're not undermining our life with negative or constricting attitudes, fear, or hatred, indifference. And instead, we are learning to regard ourselves with care and patience and kindness. Yeah, so this basic wish for well-being when the heart, our own heart, is not hindered or constricted, that's what metta is. This basic wish for well-being. And when it meets difficulty, it becomes compassion. And when it meets goodness, it becomes joy, or what we call sympathetic joy. And these, all of these heart states, mind states, are said to be all that's really needed to remove tension or bring peace in a space of conflict, and just generally heal the wounds or the hurts that we suffer in this struggle for existence. Supporting us in building harmonious communities. And it sounds a little bit lofty, like just this intention toward kindness and care. But we see it, particularly, it's really fascinating to me. We see it around the winter holidays, the Christian holiday of Christmas, when friendliness and joy is at its highest, it seems, throughout the year, where there's less distance or caution around reaching out, extending friendliness, right? There's this renewed hope, it feels, that we can promote this brotherhood, this, or humanhood, connection with other human beings, right? Loosening the forces of the ego, the me and mind. And so we're invited in this practice to investigate our experience all the other months of the year, right? When we approach with expectations, or when we pick a side or have our guard up, metta is a sort of loving accountability for our blind spots, our bias. And by connecting to this intention, we can make the inquiry, what are we feeding? What exactly are we setting in motion? Are we feeding faith, trust, love, or rage, or fear? Like, is this way that we relate to ourselves, our circumstances, one another? Is it habituating connection or disconnection? begin to get sensitive to, because that's what this practice invites us or conditions us to become, is sensitive to our experience and one another. And we can become really aware of where we're just numbing out. And the question is, numbness ever necessary? Is it ever wise? Buddhism never tires, if you study, or pointing out that this relational world is ever changing, unstable, unpredictable. And that our happiness, our awareness, isn't conditioned on this world, our experience, our relationships being without incident, completely predictable. Like, if our relationships, if our lives that we, the conditions that we depend on, can change, or even we know they can change or disappear at any moment. And I'm not just talking about like the relationship with one another, right? We know that relationships ebb and flow, and people come and go in our lives, not only as a result of passing, the end of life, but this growth away and toward one another. But it's also our relationship to things, to our activities, to our own bodies, right? All of the other aspects of our life that are constantly ebbing and flowing, changing, not predictable. But if our happiness was dependent on nothing changing, it would be a very difficult existence. Right now, there's hundreds of Hollywood screenwriters who are striking. And so, if my Wednesday evening happiness depends on fresh script of my favorite show, and in the coming weeks that doesn't happen, and that's an oversimplified example, certainly, but an example of how so many conditions come together that we often rely on to create space that we use to define happiness. David Ricoh is an author and Buddhist practitioner from some mental health, behavioral health background. And he wrote a book many years ago now, but it was one that I went back to repeatedly as a support in my own this relational development in my marriage. The title is How to Be an Adult in Relationship. But he had a definition of loving kindness that has really stayed with me over the years, because it really points to just what I'm saying, how we have, many of us have been conditioned to associate love or care, kindness, with the sort of ideal, how things should be. But he says, loving kindness, sort of in some, this isn't an exact quote, but a kindly support of your path, no matter how unusual, right? No matter how unusual. So many of us, our path to where we are presently in our relationships or in our professional career or in our spiritual journey, likely has been a windy path, right? Not a clear and direct path. And he says, a kindly support of your path, no matter how unusual, of your feelings, no matter how disturbing, and really just normalizing, right, this arising of a range of feelings, intense, perhaps shocking, use the word disturbing. Just normalizing that this arising is conditioned arising, nature, and it doesn't make us not worthy of care, of love, and of our deficiencies, he says, no matter how irritating. Which I like, just this normalizing of human nature, the way that we show up in the world, doing our best to be happy, to be content. And still, you know, we rub up against one another in ways that are not smooth, that are not always skillful. But the function, if you will, of metta, of loving kindness, is to remove resentments, to perfect our capacity to wish happiness and provide happiness, not only for ourselves, but to all beings without exception. And not as we define happiness, right? But a happiness from where another person is, just as they are. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I still hold a lot of judgments or opinions, views about folks and the choices they make, how they live their life. It's that conditioning or habit to want to put people into categories, right? Simplify things. Are you a friend? Are you a foe? Are you trustworthy or not? And this word metta, which is related to the word mitta or friend, really just means universal friendliness. Being able to be friends with all of life. And this absolutely is not a practice of not closing our hearts to anyone. Right. It is a practice, sorry. It is a practice of not closing our hearts to anyone, even though they've behaved unskillfully. Many of us as lay practitioners, maybe on retreat or as part of our daily life, have taken the precepts, these vows to be skillful in our lives, not causing harm or killing, not taking that which is not given, being skillful in our speech, truthful, not divisive or harsh, not deluding our minds with substances or drink or media, or any of the things that we indulge in to take us away. And this vow to use our body, our sex, in a way that doesn't cause harm, that shows respect for ourselves and others. And we know, each of us knows someone who has not been skillful all of the time in all of those ways. And perhaps we can reflect on a time long ago or even recently that we ourselves weren't skillful in our relationship and in our interaction with others. And still, this practice is staying close, not closing our heart, not holding in judgment and categorizing folks who are deserving or not deserving of kindness. And this equanimity, the stability of heart, heart that's able to be with what is, what's difficult or what's pleasant without closing down or grasping. And when we're not concerned over the wrongs done by others, we really are able to perfect this abiding in loving kindness. And this abiding, when sustained over time, it really gives rise to this sense of peace. And metta is not at all a passionate response of feeling. We often, I think, get confused around the word love and what that means. But metta is really a mental factor that can be cultivated. We don't have to know if someone is good or bad. We don't have to waste our time discriminating. The Buddha taught metta in various contexts and for various purposes as the basis for concentration or focus of mind. It's a practice of happiness, as we commonly practice, and also as the antidote to fear. Many of you have maybe know the story of the monks who were practicing in the woods and became quite frightened of all of the tree spirits and went back to the Buddha and said, "We just can't practice there. We just can't do it." And three times the Buddha, he went, they went back to the Buddha, and the Buddha sent them back to the woods. His teaching was to offer metta, loving kindness. This kind, patient, allowing of how experiences, how our conditions are, whether we're alone, experiencing some physical pain or emotional pain, illness, loss. It was the Buddha's antidote for all conditions of experience. Not only for individuals, but as this way of living in accord with community, a way of understanding the heart's capacity. It wasn't about feeling good, right? The metta was not about us feeling good, but I mean, some understanding and closeness with our intentions. So there's, I don't remember where this came from. And even though the mind has been softened with the moisture of loving kindness, without equanimity, one cannot purify the requisites of enlightenment and cannot dedicate one's requisites of merit along with the results to furthering the welfare of beings. So even if we have this intention of loving kindness, in the absence of Equanimity, right? And that means everything is included just as it is. And this awakening, this freedom from suffering just can't occur. The conditions just won't support this awakening. And I appreciate like this exploration of equanimity, which is upekkha is the Pali word. It's most commonly translated as equanimity, and it one of the translations or definitions means to look over, right? To look without filters. And it really refers to this ability to see without being caught by what we see. Right? This being for or against, or this pull to create a narrative so that it matches a preference that we have, or yeah. And equanimity in the list of paramis, the characteristics to support, our support this journey on the path to awakening, is mentioned immediately after loving kindness. And it's said because it purifies our capacity to express this benevolence toward all beings. And to show this non-reactivity that we must maintain, right? We have to hold toward the wrongs inflicted by others. Because the equanimity, it is this all-inclusive. And the Buddha explicitly states, right, or recommends developing metta in two situations where it's especially important and especially difficult. One, when others are hurting us, there's the simile of the saw. Buddha says, even if your limbs are being sawed off, you offer metta. And when you realize that you've hurt others, these are the two situations where it can be especially difficult to maintain the skillful intention toward care, to remain impartial even toward not only those who might be wishing us ill will, but even those who are wishing us well, right? The ego doesn't get hooked by being stroked. This isn't about only having a positive and good experience or only seeking, and nor is it being indifferent to unpleasant or difficult. The function of equanimity is to see things impartially. We're not for or not against. And it doesn't by any means mean that we don't recognize that which is unskillful, that which causes harm. It's this capacity to be close to just the way that it is. Imperfect, ever changing, and not personal to ourselves. This equanimity as it's manifested, supports the diminishing or subsiding greed, of aversion. When there's, maybe you've had this experience, when there's not equanimity, right? When the mind is pulled in this direction, pulled in that direction, with our preferences, our judgments, the mind just, it just spins, it just goes, oscillates. And it makes it almost impossible to practice allowing, letting go, demand that experience is solid, unchanging. And so we practice returning, staying close to this mind that's been conditioned to want certainty, to want predictability, to not want that which is unpleasant, unpleasing. And we know how fleeting that is. And so we practice moment by moment, not demanding anything to be other than it is. We don't get rocked or pulled off our square, remaining true to this intention when we hear unskillful speech spilling out of our own mouths, perhaps. Or wake up in the middle of a spoonful of ice cream as we're trying to not experience a racing mind or an anxious mind. That we slow and settle to stay close. And cultivating this mind that isn't reactive, isn't inclined to fix or avoid or solve before pausing long enough to have a fullness of understanding before we say no. It's saying yes, it's like this right now. And it's not a passive acceptance. It's a understanding that's rooted in insight. Just to be here with what's here right now, what's happening right now, aware of our habit states of mind to judge and reject, and often in my meditation, use the phrases nowhere to go, nothing to do. So you see the mind often launching into the future to be prepared or scripted for things that are yet to come. Replaying what's already been done. And this practice of equanimity is being fully open to like what's come to be knowing things as they have come to be right now without resistance. And this equanimity is based on this a very vigilant presence of mind. It has to be the intentional, deliberate training, not just a casual outcome of a passing mood. The sutta talks about equanimity based on, there is an equanimity that's based on delusion. That's not the one that we're practicing for, right? Where we're equanimous essentially because we're ignorant, right? Don't know what's going on, or there's an indifference. But truly, in its perfection, like, equanimity is not dull or heartless. It's not an I don't care attitude. Like, that really is the near enemy, this indifference or apathy, where we can misunderstand equanimity as non-action. But truly, as diligent practitioners, when we witness actions that cause harm, wisdom and compassion want to act to alleviate that suffering. Equanimity supports us in not flailing about. When we can have a mind that is balanced rather than reactive around what other people do or how other people engage, it frees up our own energy to allow us to act skillfully. And this is like the intersection of courage and equanimity, this coming together and staying in contact, where we bring this aspect of intention to the foreground and quietly naming what's happening right now. Like when I stumbled through the chant, just naming all of the feels that came up, right? The ego that comes up that wants to get it right, and this is my first time here. And not turning away from that in all the ways that we do. Maybe not while we're in meditation, but turning on the television, going to the device. We stay right here. And whatever door you come in, metta, karuna, mudita, or equanimity, it's a bridge to all of those other qualities. Metta and karuna and mudita are most fully expressed certainly when equanimity is present. Equanimity is the expression of wisdom in relationship, and this wisdom moves us in the direction of letting go and acting out of, frees us from acting out of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's a support in holding all of the joys and all of the sorrows without being sucked in. How it should be, what we want it to be, or flattened by the sorrows. The perpetual harm that is perpetrated against, that we as human beings perpetrate against one another, namely these mass shootings that just continue to escalate. Not even mass shootings recently. There's folks who are doing regular things in the world, making a turning around in someone's driveway or pulling into someone's driveway to turn around. Mundane, non-threatening behaviors that resulted in their death. Like when we look cumulatively, it can be disabling. We can feel stuck, not know what to do. When we start right here where we are, which is all we can do, there has to be this confidence that our intention, informed by our practice, informs our actions. It matters. It matters. And is there a place in your life, in your day, that kindness isn't warranted or kindness doesn't seem like the right move? Are we relating to our experience with wisdom, with compassion, with kindness? Or are we relating to one another with fear, hatred, judgment? The Buddha said, the world may quarrel with me, but I do not quarrel with the world. And it's not about who's right or who's to blame. There has always been war. Babies born, people passing, dying every day. Kindnesses expressed and great harm. And as we become less judgmental and more skilled at holding the joys and the sorrows, the ease and the hardship, we're better able to understand that things and people are the way they are as a result of nature, these complex and legitimate causes and conditions. And as we understand our impact, what we're setting in motion. Right? This nature isn't something that happens outside of us. Right? We are nature. Our capacity for equanimity increases. And equanimity isn't just like a decision or something that comes out of this force of will. It really is a deep understanding of the nature of reality, right? Three marks of existence. Anicca, right? That everything is subject to change. Dukkha. Everything holds an element of unsatisfactoriness. And the people will sometimes say that the Buddha taught suffering and the end of suffering, or that life is suffering. The Buddha did teach suffering and the end of suffering, but not that life is suffering. But this this conditioned desire that at some point we reach a pinnacle of pleasantness and pleasing. And the flower blooms and the bloom wilts eventually. And the third mark of existence, anatta, this no self is what it's commonly taught, how it's commonly stated. It's just differentiating, right? This between ourselves and another, this comparing. There's this space or distance. And when we begin to see ourselves in one another, like our capacity for softening, for this balance of mind grows. We understand, we come to this understanding that there will be heartbreak. And that truth, coming to that understanding of that truth, leads to a stable heart, a balanced mind. Right? We're not confused or lost or stuck in this wish, desire. That all will be well all of the time. I think that much of this path is about letting go. Leaving something behind, as much as it is establishing some tensions for balanced mind, open heart, skillful actions. It's really like letting go of these poisons, greed, hatred, delusion. This pull, this desire that that goes unchecked, unnoticed so much of the time. We've come to lean on it or accept it as fair and reasonable. On this equanimity, there's two forms of equanimity. One that comes from this observation, right? Seeing the truth of the way that it is, not the way that we want it to be, or the way that we believe it should be. And this equanimity that comes from this inner balance that I've been talking about. And they come together in our mindfulness practice, meditation. And we see or feel, understand that this suffering comes from wanting to replace some unpleasant feeling with something pleasant. And I imagine many of you can reflect on, maybe even today, like not this now, not this knee pain, or not this worry or doubt. And we look naturally for an escape. But with our practice, meditation practice, and being in community with other folks, just like we are here, who hold this intention to live skillfully, to stay close to the truth. And we begin to understand that because something is unpleasant, doesn't mean it's a problem. A big problem has been our inability to be with what's unpleasant. How many times do we, on meditation retreats, get the swallows, right? Swallow to get out of the discomfort, or scratch an itch, or clear our throat, shift in our seat, just to get out of the discomfort, which we learn. It doesn't get us out of our discomfort. It's like not quite enough. And when we do this, we actually lose the opportunity to see what's on the other side. We lose knowing our capacity to be close. So, learning how to open to discomfort. Really means not reacting to the impulse or preference, but acting from a place of wisdom and compassion, from a place of kind curiosity. Because we're transforming the mind in order to inform our actions, this relational, how we show up with one another. And it's right now, right? Not after one more retreat or finish this study. Like as best we can, softening and opening to ourselves and to one another. Like our work is really to cultivate a heart that loves without stopping to judge who's deserving or what we'll get in return or how we'll be perceived. Just caring. Without exception. And when we understand that experience is just conditions unfolding, when we see or experience people that are annoying or unreliable or hurtful, on this path, it quickly it gets easier to see how their actions are actually caused by many, many things, many, many conditions. And so we understand that much, not if not most or all of what is going on with them. It's actually not about us personally. It's not a willful targeting, but this perhaps unskillful, unpracticed expression of hurt. This, and underneath that is this desire, as we all share, this universal desire to be happy. to be free, to be at ease. And so we get more secure in our ability to see clearly, to respond to the great, great needs of our time. It's a collective responsibility. Like, this is our collective problem. This feeling that is desperately needed in many of our own hearts, in our communities for certain, in our institutions and organizations. We all are gaining the ability to lean into and walk through the difficult. And this is actually called advanced gratitude in Buddhism, right? It's gratitude for difficulties. Like, this is where wisdom arises, like being able to see, being able to understand the lesson, the teaching in difficulty. And so in some ways, to some degree, gratitude becomes a resource for us. It helps us sit with pain or difficulty. It's still pain. It's still difficult. There's I used to have a magnet on my refrigerator. It said, "If you're going through hell, keep going." To mean that's the only way through. It's the only way through. We can't go around, get over, get under. It's this capacity to bear witness to harm, to the big and small ways that we grind against one another, bear witness to the ways that we've invested in staying comfortable or making others comfortable. And at what risk? Sacrificing truth. We have to be able to walk in the storm. And before you know, the step, I am certainly guilty of this, like, identify the problem, lay out the solution, implement, move on. Like, right, many of us professionally are conditioned to this thinking. But in our practice, right, the step before trying to find a solution or taking action is this understanding, is simply holding with care, being with. The classic teaching of equanimity is tied to the teaching of karma, based on fully understanding that what is here, arising based on causes and conditions. That our happiness or unhappiness is connected to our actions and choices, not only in the past, but like how we're relating to it right now. And certainly that's not to say that, you know, the difficulty and challenge in one's life, my own, yours, is your just desserts. And certainly it's the result of many, many causes and conditions, and it's here. And it's here now. And it seems there's this pull, it's very seductive. It seems that the deep dive in unpacking and understanding all of the intricacies of how it got to be this way now will lead to some relief. And sometimes that may, sometimes it may not. Our challenge. Our challenge, test is the word that came to mind. I was trying to pull up a different word than test. Our test is to meet what's here right now with this tenderness, metta. Right? Seeing our experience, seeing the world through the eyes of benevolence. And it's not a magic eraser. Right, where everything becomes good and right. But we're better able to see where the world is friendly, where the world isn't as scary as the narrative that we've created. And we see the lessening of separation between us. And we can let the circumstances of our lives harden us. And some deeply traumatic experiences can certainly do that. Leaving us resentful, afraid. I really think at any time we can come back to this path, this practice of letting our circumstances soften us. Open to what scares us. Allow it to make us kinder. We'll be much better at picking up the pieces if we're not falling to pieces ourselves. And when things are falling apart, if we're not falling apart, this isn't to win favors, this showing up with care and love, or to get something. It's just love for the sake of love. The Buddha taught that the divine abodes, these divine resting places for the heart mind, leave no room for fear and judgment, greed, hatred, delusion. And so that's why we pick up, we practice meeting experience with care, without filter. Yes, metta meets difficulty, softens with to compassion. And there's another experiencing joy. It becomes sympathetic joy. And this isn't, as you all know, I expect, instantaneous, or once you have a a meta experience that you don't have to practice meta anymore, right? The Buddha, time and time again, taught the need for skillful effort, diligence, skillful exertion, this unflagging perseverance as we unravel this deep, deep conditioning to protect and guard and separate. And we really have to act as if and believe that our actions will radically transform not only this heart, but the world. A small act of kindness, seemingly small. It's actually quite radical to be able to meet another human being or even ourselves without the demand or expectation, but with the softness of kindness and curiosity. And we have to do that all the time. Like this transformation of this heart and transformation of the world. It's diligence and perseverance all of the time. I think I'll leave it there. Maybe just one last. The Buddha said, "Monks, these two people are hard to find in the world. Which two? The one who is first to do a kindness, and the one who is grateful for a kindness done and feels obligated to repay it. These two people are hard to find in the world." Let us be that light for one another to do a kindness and receive the kindness of others. Leave it there. Thank you for your kind attention. Maybe we can just let the words fall away for a minute, and if there are questions or reflections, we'll have a few minutes for that. Well, I do appreciate all of you spending your evening here and your kind attention and your practice. Yeah, it's wonderful to join your community this evening.